Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. I'm really excited today because I love this topic. And one of our Down the Pub regulars is the one that brought it to the table. Kit, tell us what you've got and who you've brought with you.
I'm really excited too. So we are going to do the First Crusade. And with us is a very good friend of mine, Dr. James Holloway. He's an expert in early medieval England based in Cambridge. And he's part of Gaming the Crusades, a project with the University of Edinburgh. James, thank you for coming along.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, I love this one. I had to do this for A-level, which is why I know about the First Crusade. I know bugger all about all the others, other than that Sean Connery crops up at some point, and that I love Saladin. So let's start right with the beginning. The origins of the First Crusade really go back all the way to the Byzantine Empire, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to put in a disclaimer right at the beginning, which is, of course, you know, we're going to call it the Byzantine Empire, but that's not what they called it. You know, they called it the Roman Empire. And also, we're going to have names in this episode that come from French, Italian, Greek, German, Armenian, Turkic, Persian, and Arabic. So I'm going to mispronounce, all kinds of things. And I apologize in advance. For that.
Sorry, not sorry.
All of our Armenian speaking listeners, I apologize. You know, I don't know how much Armenian stuff we're going to get into, but it's out there. So yeah, so the origins of the First Crusade, I mean, you can go back quite a long way with them, but I think a lot of people start in the 1070s with the aftermath of the Battle of Manzikert. And Manzikert has been portrayed as this like enormous military defeat that destroys the Byzantine army and allows the Seljuk Turks to flood into Byzantine territory. And I think that that's probably overstating the case, somewhat. It's a very convenient beginning for a period of political instability that's going to last throughout the entire 1070s. And that's not going to end until, Emperor Alexius I emerges as the winner of this succession crisis. The emperor is captured by the Turks during the Battle of Manzikert, and even though he's later released, the fact that the emperor's off the board even for a short time just triggers the Byzantine instinct for vicious and protracted succession conflicts. And so the real winners out of this are the Seljuks again. And again, like modern sort of like popular portrayals of the Crusades have a tendency to show them as these conflicts between Islam and Christianity. But actually the Seljuks who do really well out of this, are Byzantine allies a lot of the time. This is the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum, which just means of Rome. They're founded by, an emir called Suleiman, who's, an on again, off again, Byzantine ally or allied with some of the various, rebels. And he founds during this period, this Seljuk Sultanate. There's also a greater Seljuk Sultanate off in Syria and Mesopotamia, from which he is a rebel, or the family member of a rebel anyway. So the Byzantine Empire is in crisis during this period. And then even once Alexius has taken the throne, he has to go herring off to deal with an invasion in the Balkans for a couple of years. And we will return to that invasion a little bit later on, because it's going to turn out to have been important. So the Byzantines are a very wealthy power, and they're very used to having kind of composite multi-ethnic armies. So, for example, in the 1030s, when they invade Sicily, their army has like Norwegians, there's people from Iceland, there's Bulgarians, there's Greeks, there's Lombards, there's Normans. I mean, that's just kind of how they operate and kind of how a lot of Mediterranean medieval armies operate. We're used to thinking of armies as kind of, oh, this is the expression of a nation, but not necessarily. So the idea of hiring some European knights to fight for the Byzantine Empire is not at all an unusual one. And in fact, one of the rebels who had to be dealt with in the 1070s was just such a knight. So the Byzantines send off some ambassadors to request assistance. And they arrive in Italy in 1095. And this is kind of interesting because I don't think we 100% know what really they were trying to accomplish. It's not something that's discussed much in the Byzantine sources as far as I know. So we only have the papal interpretation of what these guys want.
Okay, so these ambassadors, they arrive in Rome from Alexius to ask help from the sort of the Western Roman Empire, essentially, what used to be the Western Roman Empire. So what happens there?
So they're received by the Pope, Urban II. They address the Council of Piacenza in 1095. And then I think what no one could have predicted is how Urban reacts. So this is when he goes on a preaching tour in France, and there he calls a church council, the Council of Clermont. And he declares this, it's not called a crusade at the time, but that, you know, Christians should take up arms and go to help liberate the oppressed Christians of the East. And in particular, he focuses on the idea of recapturing Jerusalem. And it's extremely hard to believe that Alexius cared about recapturing Jerusalem, which hadn't been in Byzantine hands for, I mean, I don't know the data off the top of my head, but it's centuries. You know, he was concerned with his immediate strategic objectives in Anatolia. Hard to see that you know, he'd care about Jerusalem very much.
So this is basically like someone going to your house and saying, you know, can you help me fix my roof? And the guy's, no worry, I'm going to buy you a new street.
It is, only if he possibly had some kind of sinister ulterior motive for buying you a new street.
He could build a Lidl at the end of it.
Exactly, right? Because Urban has, he's a product of this church reform school. He was an ally of Pope Gregory VII, who's best remembered for being the pope in the investiture controversy of the 1070s, an enemy of the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV. And he's maybe a little subtler than Gregory, but Urban is definitely trying to give a little boost to papal power and prestige, which has suffered over the previous decades. There's an invasion by the emperor, and there's an anti-pope gets set up, and it's all, you know, the dignity of the office maybe is not what it once was. And you know, he could do with a win, and he could certainly do with a win that would help with the idea of centralizing some kind of large-scale activity under papal authority, and furthermore, giving some kind of church blessing or regulation to the military aristocracy who have this conflict. It's actually something that turns up in a few of the sources from this time, is this idea that people like Tancred are worried about the apparent contradiction that they're supposed to be, you know, good Christians, but they spend their lives in robbery and violence.
I'm really keen to ask a crusade expert, because there's a layman who's just read a couple of books. I look at, because we all know the shit show that the crusades end up causing, and the legacy still in the Middle East of the conflict between religions. To what extent does a crusade expert look at Urban and go, you, like I do?
I see. I mean, disclaiming that I don't know that I would go so far as to call myself an expert, but I'll get into that in, well, maybe I'll get into that later. But I don't know. I don't think, obviously you try not to have that attitude.
Yeah.
Right? But we're interested in studying the thing as it is, and there's not good guys and bad guys. We're just studying a historical process. And this is one of those instances where a lot of the time you look at some historical development and you say, if this had not happened then, it would have happened at some point, right? Urban didn't come up with the idea of, you know, church patronage or authorization for wars against Muslim communities, because obviously this is something that happens in Spain to some extent already. You know, he certainly didn't come up with the idea of papal authorization for military expeditions. That happens in the Norman Conquest, that happens in other places. So all the pieces maybe are there.
Okay.
Maybe Urban just puts them together in a new way. And in terms of the legacy of conflict between Christians and Muslims, you know, we're going to see quite a complex picture of that when people actually get into contact with Muslim communities, because there will be opportunities for alliances with Muslim states. At the same time, certainly it's a it's a divisive legacy in the Middle East. So whether I don't know that you can point to Urban necessarily and say this is all your fault, but there's definitely one of the things that I think is so compelling about the First Crusade is that it is a period where people are playing with matches, where we're in kind of uncharted territory in terms of, you know, relations with the Byzantine Empire, in terms of relations with these Muslim states who are very not very well understood in Europe, many of whom are brand new or are otherwise in transition. And so it really is this kind of weird, unstable situation where anything could happen. And then into that situation where anything could happen, someone decides to have a big, cool idea. And then,
yeah,
you know, as, that has unpredictable consequences. And Urban, of course, is not going to find out about this because he's going to die before the First Crusade ends.
So what's really interesting, and I think a lot of our listeners won't know this, is that the first big mass of people that goes east are not soldiers, are they? So what is the, or not primarily a big group of an army going? Mm-hmm. What is the People's Crusade and what is the impact of it?
So the People's Crusade is something that I think we maybe know. We don't have the same level of detailed sources for it that we do for the later part of the First Crusade, the so-called Prince's Crusade, because those people have chaplains with them who are writing things down. The People's Crusade is kind of this mixture of lesser lords and apparently just, you know, common people and charismatic preachers, the most famous of whom is this figure called Peter the Hermit. And certainly, because it doesn't go very well, certainly later historians are like, oh, this stupid rabble. And focus their attention on the Prince's Crusade. But so yeah, the People's Crusade are these people who get very fired up about going to Jerusalem, and they actually set off, because they're not as organized, they set off a good deal before the main part of the Crusade. So the People's Crusade, get moving in, well, so, for example, Peter the Hermit will eventually get to Constantinople in August 1096, which is around when most of the rest of the Crusaders are leaving to go to Constantinople. And they're not going to get there until, you know, anywhere between October 1096 and April 1097. And the People's Crusade are probably most famous for, well, for two things. First, for the violence that they commit against Jewish communities. Now, that's not, I don't know that the Prince's Crusade are completely innocent of that. Certainly later Jewish sources are critical of Godfrey, who we'll get to in a sec. But that is probably what they're most notable for. And for then, after causing a lot of trouble, turning up in Constantinople and like looting houses and fighting the police and what, well, not police, but fighting imperial troops, they eventually cross over to Anatolia, where they start raiding and plundering in the area around Nicaea and promptly get wiped out by the Seljuks. And some of them do survive and go on to, you know, they go back to Constantinople and join up with the later wave of crusaders. But what's really interesting about the People's Crusade is that it shows that there was this level of popular enthusiasm, of religiously motivated popular enthusiasm, right? That we're not just appealing to this, you know, the nobility with strong ties to the church, but actually that there's something about this that does engage the popular imagination. And we're going to see that a couple of times in the First Crusade, that the ordinary crusaders sometimes dissent from the overall strategic objectives. You get this, we'll look back at it later on in 1099 when Raymond of Toulouse has some plans that he thinks make sound strategic sense, but his troops just really want to go to Jerusalem because they don't care if Raymond gets some castle.
So the People's Crusade is basically like a rugby tour, but just going through Europe, trashing a place.
Maybe. There's some evidence that there are more organized elements in it. You know, there are knights out there with their followers, but it's not centralized in any way. But then when we get to the Prince's Crusade, we're going to see that it's also not centralized.
Well, let's talk about it. Let's go to the Prince's Crusade, because while the People's Crusade is getting absolutely destroyed, literally a couple of hundred miles away from Constantinople, they don't get very far.
No, they didn't get very far.
The nobles of Europe have been assembling their forces. So who are the princes of the Prince's Crusade?
So lots of people get put on the list. For the sake of brevity, I think we can kind of look at three main figures and then we'll have a little crowd of others. You know, they'd be, if this were a TV show, the other princes would be the ones that you look at and you go, oh, I've seen him in things. So our three, we'll take them from north to south. Our three kind of the people who at some point in their career can be considered the leader of the First Crusade, are Godfrey of Bouillon. So Godfrey is not unlike a lot of these other crusaders. He is he's actually a second son as opposed to just being treated like a second son. He inherited the Duchy of Lower Lorraine from his uncle. And the really interesting thing about Godfrey is he then has to kind of prove his claim to Lorraine by being a close supporter of Emperor Henry IV. So what's really fascinating about Godfrey is that he is not a natural supporter of Urban. And when we get to the other two, we're going to see that they are people who already have ties to the papacy and to papal supporters. But Godfrey doesn't. He fought in the siege of Rome. He was on the other side. So again, it's more evidence of the appeal of this idea. You know, it reaches people who maybe would not normally be receptive to a papal initiative like this. And if that means nothing more than that aristocrats in medieval Europe love going on pilgrimages. it's the best. They love like a pilgrimage and fighting.
There's rugby tour.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, and Godfrey, like he's all in. Like you can see their financial records indicate, you know, that he's like sold or mortgaged large amounts of property. He had to raise a huge amount of money in order to fund this expedition, because it's not like the Pope's paying for it. As anyone could have expected. So he's very, clearly very committed to this idea. Then going a little further south, we've got Raymond of Toulouse, Raymond IV, Count of Toulouse. He's sort of the oldest of the leaders. He's about 10 to 15 years older than either Godfrey or the next person we're going to talk about. And wealthier than most of them. Despite the fact that we're going to get some people with quite prominent ties to royalty, Raymond is actually, he's pretty well off. And, he is a close ally of, Admar of Le Puy, who is the papal legate, who is kind of the Pope's liaison with the crusade. And Admar, at the Council of Clermont, Urban proclaims the crusade, and then Admar jumps up and begs to be sent, which, considering that Urban had visited Le Puy shortly before that, this was probably a prearranged, spontaneous act of religious devotion. And Raymond is an old ally of Admar, who in turn is an old ally of, Urban. So, they have, he's kind of more who you'd expect. And then finally, when we get down to Italy, we've got, the sort of the odd duck of the bunch, Bohemond of Taranto. He's the son of
my favorite.
He's my favorite too. I mean, he's just such a character who's representative of the age, right? He's kind of he's the son of a Norman duke in southern Italy, Robert Giscard, and he is the eldest son. But in fact, the duchy has passed to his younger half brother, Roger Borsa, because. For a number of reasons, but mainly because Bohemond is Robert's child by his first marriage, and Mum is still around to support Roger Borsa. But that's not quite right. He's also got the support of the uncles. The uncles are very important. There's a lot of members of the Hauteville family in southern Italy, like a lot. And Bohemond is merely the tallest. Bohemond is someone whose kind of territorial possessions in southern Italy don't match up with his level of military experience. He was sort of Robert's right-hand man during a previous campaign, and he's certainly the most experienced field commander of all the senior crusade leaders, and that's something that they're going to kind of call on quite a lot. But he's lower in sort of wealth and prestige than people like Raymond. or Godfrey. He's not really a proper count like they are, and his grandfather was, like, essentially a pirate. You know, just, like, with a horse instead of a ship. So he's not, he doesn't have the glamour that they do. Then we've got a little cloud of other guys, all of whom are fascinating, and I'd love to talk about them, but, we have, Hugh de Vermandois. He's the King of France's not terribly useful brother. Actually, I say that. He turns out to be quite useful later on in the Crusade because the fact that he's a member of the French royal family makes him this excellent ambassador. And he winds up getting sent on sort of diplomatic missions a fair bit. But he does run away from the Crusade at one point when things are getting tough. Anna Komnena tells a funny story about how he sends a bragging – he basically like cuts a brag track to Alexius talking about how great he is and then gets shipwrecked on the way and shows up destitute. And whether – whether this is true or not, or just Anna making fun of him, I don't know.
But, I want it to be true.
Yeah, it's certainly, he has this kind of like, in the text, he has this kind of like sad sack quality to him, yeah. Which is quite endearing, but I don't know if it's actually, you know, whether that reflects a historical reality or not. Speaking of brothers of kings, we've got Duke Robert of Normandy, Robert Curthose. He is, of course, the jilted elder brother of the King of England. He's backed up by a bunch of Normans from actual Normandy, as opposed to Bohemond, whose troops are Normans from southern Italy. So it's kind of like there's a definite sort of superfluous brothers club thing going on with the Crusade, especially since, according to one text later on, Edgar the Atheling, a member of the English royal entourage who is himself a very plausible claimant to the English throne, is going to turn up. It's a bit weird because we're not sure about the timing. He was in England very shortly before that. So whether he was really there or not.
About Prince Harry would have been with them if he was out at the time.
Yeah, right. Like, it's just like, what do you want to do?
Well, I'm not... could have been worked out on the First Crusade.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not really needed, so I'm going to go be a soldier of fortune. Yeah. You know,
as opposed to moving to LA.
One of them, Stephen, he's married to William the Conqueror's daughter, isn't he? And he sort of,
yes.
She basically forces him to go on crusade.
Yeah, he's Robert's brother-in-law. So they're sort of a little northern French group. So Robert's there, Stephen is there. Also there's another Robert of Flanders, who definitely kind of should have, and also in front of his name, like, and also Robert of Flanders. But he turns up, you know, again, I feel like I'm denigrating them. Poor old Stephen has a rough go of it as well. He fails to fulfill his vow and then actually has to go back and do a second try. Also not successfully. He actually dies trying to do that. So there's some, you know, not everybody is like, we've been through this filtering process where we all realize later on that Bohemond is, you know, this preeminent character. But I don't know if you would have necessarily thought that in 1096.
I think one thing I just want to point out in case our listeners aren't getting it. I mean, yeah, the English are all over the later Crusades, but this one is so French / Norman in flavor, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Like, it's very much, you got sort of Northern French and Southern French, and then you've got Normans from Italy.
Yeah.
This
is why 900 years later in World War One. The French claim that when the Middle East gets divided up, they should have Syria because they went there first with this. That's their argument.
That feels like a bit of a reach.
Yeah, there was the Committee of Asia, French Committee of Asia. That was their argument for saying that Syria was essentially French.
That's one of those, like, you didn't do the reading, like, first paragraph of the essay. Kind of
or
moments.
You just,
like,
did Wikipedia for research.
Yeah. So, like, please explain your claim to Syria on the first page. When Godfrey of Bouillon arrived in, yeah. Like, is that right?
Yeah.
There's also, because this is the Middle Ages, these people are they're accompanied in many cases by their families. I mentioned obviously Stephen is Robert's brother-in-law. Bohemond is ably seconded by his nephew Tancred. Godfrey's got one of his brothers with him and also some various cousins who are frustratingly, quite a lot of them are called Baldwin.
That got really confusing at A-level.
Yeah, there were not a lot of names to go around in the Middle Ages, apparently. Two of the sons of the original Tancred, not this Tancred, but two of the brothers of Robert Giscard have the same first name.
Yeah, there's a guy in England at the same time, and this is my favourite anecdote about the aristocracy of the 1100s. We had so many bastards, and you know the prefix is Fitz. Mm-hmm. So we had a Fitz William, Fitz Harold, and then by number 10, the guy was called Fitz Other.
Yeah, it's very like that. And again, it interestingly goes to show, because the two Williams who are sons of Tancred, they're very far apart in his list of sons. So you would never confuse one for the other. Like, they're different generations. So it sort of works, because, you know, that's why they all have colorful nicknames. Like, Bohemond's real name is Mark.
It wouldn't have the same effect, would it?
No, but, you know, but there's presumably a lot of other people called Mark, and therefore he's called Bohemond.
And Bohemond is pretty controversial when it comes to helping out the Byzantine Empire, though, isn't he?
Yeah, this is kind of one of those awkward moments. Or is it? So remember I mentioned that there was this invasion of the Byzantine Empire in the early 1080s. That was Bohemond. It was him and his father. So Robert Giscard had this, again, remember, there are lots of things that are going on in this period that in hindsight we look at and think that could never work. But lots of things that previously had been thought could never work had just worked in the 11th century, right? So the Norman conquest of southern Italy is going great. Sicily's developing. England obviously happened. So the Normans kind of have this sort of, you know, oh, we give this a go. Like, the last thing didn't seem like it would work out, but why not? Sort of sense to it.
There's no Twitter to trash you for your hypocrisy as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, but he gets trashed for his hypocrisy. He just doesn't care, right? Like, yeah, Bohemond doesn't read the comments.
Yeah. Anna's comments on Bohemond are sort of quite interesting, because she's blatantly got a girl crush on him.
Yeah, but she also hates him. It's fascinating. She's writing within we could talk about Anna, but Anna is writing within like a tradition of, so I'm sorry, Anna Komnena is Alexius's daughter. And later on, she's quite young at this point, later on she writes a history of his reign, the Alexiad. And so she's you know, she's quite rare as a woman writing about history in the Middle Ages, and she's a very interesting figure in that respect. But it is important to know that when she's writing all this stuff, she knows the ending already. So she knows that when Bohemond makes this deal with the emperor in 1097, she knows he's going to crayfish later on. So she paints him as this kind of scoundrelly, dishonorable character, because she knows that eventually he'll break the agreement. And so she tells all these stories about how deceptive he is right from the start. But at the same time, she provides this physical description that is, it's this super macho. She talks about how huge he is and how neatly shaven he is.
It's a bit pervy, isn't it?
Yeah, but then all of Anna's descriptions are like that. And when considering that, like, she kind of mainly writes about her father, it's a bit...
Yeah, it's just become my sole ambition in life to have an autobiography or a blog called The Alexiad now.
Yeah, well, exactly. So if you go back and read a lot of Byzantine historians, with a few exceptions, most obviously Procopius, what to a Byzantine reader would read like a scathing criticism, to us feels revoltingly servile. Like, flattery was just a highly developed art among Byzantine historians. So yeah, in the 1080s, yes, Robert Giscard had tried to like solve the problem of having these two prominent sons by carving out a little extra principality for Bohemond out of Byzantine territories in the Balkans. And indeed, they chase off Alexius himself at the Battle of Dyrrhachium. The Byzantines are very good at what they do, and what they do is try to win wars without fighting as much as possible. So, for example, the Byzantines have been keeping a spare heir to the Norman Duchy of Apulia in the pocket just in case the Normans started to cause trouble. That's Robert's nephew, Abelard. And so they just send him back to Apulia to start causing trouble. And they get in touch with Emperor Henry IV and they say, boy, you know, that Pope, he's a bad guy. You should probably do something about him. And then the Pope sends panicky letters to the Normans asking them to come back and help, and so on and so on. So, the whole thing kind of comes to nothing. And worst of all, in 1085, as they're kind of like trying to start getting the campaign going again, Robert dies. So Bohemond winds up spending most of his time alternatively supporting and feuding with the other members of his family, rather than conquering the Balkans. So on the one hand, Bohemond has incredibly valuable experience. He speaks Greek. He has experience fighting Turkic light horse. Like, he understands the strategies you need to deal. He knows the terrain. He knows the way to get from southern Italy to Thessaloniki. All fantastic. The only problem is that the way he learned all those things was invading the Byzantine Empire. So Alexius is not going to be too happy to see him when he turns up. But on the other hand, part of Alexius's like characteristically Byzantine diplomatic strategy is he's always working with people that have previously been his enemies. That's just kind of how medieval politics goes. You know, you need to forge alliances with people who were trying to kill you yesterday and pretend like they're your best friends. So we're going to see that a couple of times during the Crusades. So, I mean, I'm sure Alexius is keeping a wary eye on Bohemond, but I'd be keeping a wary eye on a lot of them. You know, there's not one of them that much less devious than the others. Bohemond, you maybe want to keep an extra eye on, as events will prove. So the Princes' Crusade, they turn up to Constantinople, and Alexius tries to get them to swear an oath to him that any territory that they capture that was previously part of the Byzantine Empire, they will return to him.
Slightly outnumbered at this point, Alexei. How do you think this is going to go?
This is the thing. I don't think he thinks that that they're going to keep it necessarily, but in the early parts of the campaign, they do. Because he's still able to provide them with very important logistical support. So, I mean, the Byzantines come off quite well out of the First Crusade. They basically get a bunch of territory that they wanted, and they don't, you know, they have to kind of, they pay for it, you know, in money, but they don't have to fight a bunch of huge battles. It's actually pretty good news for them, although, of course, they will then be left with this lasting legacy of annoying Franks. Franks, incidentally, kind of the overall
900-year legacy by the time it gets
right, exactly.
And everything, yeah.
Yeah. But you know, they got short-term problems to think about.
Mm-hmm. So the Crusaders have all got to Constantinople. They have begun marching across modern-day Turkey, this Sultanate of Rome. What happens next?
So their first target is the city of Nicaea. This is effectively the capital of the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum. And the good news is that the Seljuks are in disarray. In fact, kind of the whole Muslim Middle East is having a rough couple of years in the 1090s. So you'll remember that I mentioned Suleiman I, Suleiman ibn Qutulmish. He was the first Seljuk Sultan of Rum. And he was killed in battle with the Great Seljuks, the sort of main Seljuk Sultanate, in 1086. And his son, Kilij Arslan, was taken as a hostage. But in 1092, the main Seljuk Sultan, Malik Shah, he dies. And Kilij Arslan returns and begins taking back the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum. The succession crisis caused by Malik Shah's death is going to last like 25 years. The Seljuk Sultanate is not a single centralized state. It's got a bunch of emirs who all have their own agendas and their own followings. And, a lot of them are kind of, powerful, independent warlords. A great example of this would be Tutush, who's one of their rulers in Syria. Only guess what? He too has recently died. He died in 1094, and he leaves behind two sons, Dukak, who's the emir of Damascus, and Ridwan, who's the emir of Aleppo. And also in 1094, the vizier of the Fatimid Caliphate, that's in Egypt, he dies, leaving behind his son to advise the emperor, Al-Mustanshir, the caliph, Al-Mustanshir. Only he dies. The caliph dies also in 1094. So it's just political instability and succession crises all round for the Seljuks and the Fatimids and the Seljuk Sultanate of Rome in the 1090s. And this is all by way of explaining why Kilij Arslan is not home when the Crusaders turn up. He is off dealing with another problem somewhere else. So they lay siege to the city of Nicaea. The problem is that Nicaea has a big lake right next to it, and the city is able to be resupplied. We're going to see that siege tactics are a real problem during the First Crusade. But eventually, so they set out, they cross over in the spring of 1097, and the siege of Nicaea begins in May 1097. Alexius has sent as a liaison officer this guy called Tetikius, who is one of his cavalry officers, and indeed fought against Bohemond during the Balkan campaign. In mid-May, the Crusaders learn that Kilij Arslan is finally on his way back with a relief force. And again, so they ride out, they defeat the Seljuk relief force, which is much smaller than the crusading army. We don't know how big the Crusader force is. Medieval estimates of army sizes
are... huge range of estimates, isn't it?
Yeah, they're wildly inaccurate.
One of them's about 100,000, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's just, that's all nonsense. When a medieval chronicler writes, like, for the next engagement, the Battle of Dorylaeum, they're going to write, there's 360,000 Turks, which just means a lot. There's a lot.
Yeah.
Once we get above a few hundred or a few thousand, these sources are completely unreliable.
It's like Liverpool saying how many people are in Anfield.
Yeah, or Arsenal with their season ticket holders when you're looking at a half-empty stadium at a Carling Cup game and it says that it's a sellout.
That sounds like it could be true.
Yeah.
This crusade is not like, it's not centrally organized. No one is in command. There's no single commander. Every, you know, lord is just kind of doing whatever they think is best. They're discussing it, but the Northern French don't even turn up until the beginning of June. And finally, what happens
from any sarky comment about the French being late for things?
Well, they've got the furthest to come.
Yeah.
So what happens is, eventually the city surrenders, but it surrenders to the Byzantines. And so the Crusaders they wanted to plunder the city, right? The city didn't surrender to them. They want to plunder it. And Alexius is like, no, this is a Byzantine city. I'm not letting you plunder my cities. The whole point of this is that this is legitimately my territory, but here, have a bunch of gold anyway. Yeah. To compensate you for your losses. And while he's here, he meets them at nearby Pelicanum, and he forces some of them to take their oaths to him, who managed to dodge it the first time. Like, Tancred showed up in Constantinople and then just skipped over the Bosphorus as quick as he could in order to avoid swearing an oath to Alexius. An oath he had no intention of keeping if he did swear it. So I guess he was just being, he wanted to be consistent. And so then, yes, and at this point, they send off some envoys to Cairo to talk to the Fatimids, because they know that the Fatimids also don't like the Seljuks. The Fatimids are urbanized, you know, sort of settled civilization. The Seljuks are a nomad aristocracy ruling a non-Seljuk populace. The Fatimids are Shiites, and the Seljuks are Sunnis, et cetera, et cetera. And also, more importantly, the Seljuks recently took a bunch of territory, including Jerusalem, off the Fatimids. So there may be some grounds for an alliance there. It's not going to work out, but that's the idea.
So the next stage, we get about halfway, don't we, with Antioch?
Yeah. So they
tell us
they,
about the siege.
They head off. The big target is Antioch. Antioch's a big city. Yeah. There's another battle on the way, the Battle of Dorylaeum. The Crusaders split up their forces to avoid supply problems, probably. The front half gets attacked by the Turks and manages to hold until the second half turns up, which is the secret, right? Like, as long as you don't go chasing the Turkic cavalry, it's going to be very uncomfortable, but hopefully your reinforcements will arrive. The Siege of Antioch is the main part of the First Crusade. Like, if you look at the calendar, so the princely armies left their home bases, you know, over a range of times between August and December 1096. They turned up in Constantinople from the autumn of 1096 to the spring of 1097. They get to Antioch in October 1097, and they're not going to leave it again really until the very end of 1098, beginning of 1099. So of the time that they spend in the Middle East, the majority of it is spent besieging or defending Antioch. There is a secondary expedition that splits off from the main party, and they go through Cilicia, which is an Armenian region where they create some alliances with the locals. I want to express the appropriate note of skepticism. Like, Baldwin manages to get adopted by an Armenian nobleman who then mysteriously dies.
One way of forming an alliance.
Yeah. What a terrible tragedy. Who could have foreseen it?
Probably the guy wielding the axe as he did
he just got assassinated.
And this is the Crusaders not really caring one whit about Jerusalem. This is them carving out territory, right?
Partly, but it's also, like, Cilicia is the more direct route from where they are to Antioch. It's just that they're concerned that it's more dangerous because to get there, you have to go through two narrow mountain passes, and they're worried that the defenders of Antioch could block those passes. So they kind of send they're securing an important communications route, but also they're capturing territory they have no intention of giving back. These alliances will prove to be very important to them in the future. So the siege of Antioch's a nightmare. Antioch is defended by a garrison commanded by a guy called Yahisian. He's an experienced and clever governor. The city is huge, and it's right along the slopes of a mountain. So, like, again, when we think of a siege, we think of digging, like, big trenches all around the city. But that's absolutely not what happens, because the Crusaders simply don't have enough people to surround the entire city. So instead, what they're doing is creating outposts along the major, like, roads into and out of the city, and just trying to intercept people going in and out. But there are frequent sorties, and there are gates to the city that remain open. The city is receiving fresh supplies throughout the siege. And if you want to say, that's not really how a siege works, you'd be right. It just kind of doesn't work great. Yahisian sends out for reinforcements, and this is where those two brothers that I mentioned earlier, Rizwan and Dukak, come in. They're kind of the closest major cities, and they separately come to the relief of Antioch at different times, and they both get beat. Or, well, maybe the first one is a draw, but he decides to go home anyway and not risk it. And the third person who's going to maybe come to Antioch's relief is the emir, or the atabe, technically, the governor of Mosul, a guy called Kerboha. And he's maybe a little bit more formidable than these two. And we'll see. He's going to come along in a little bit. But for now, the Crusaders, the siege is just dragging on, right? So the siege really starts in at the end of October 1097. They've got the port of San Simeon, which allows them to get resupplied by sea. So a Genoese fleet turns up in November. The Genoese are hugely important in terms of supplying the Crusade. They don't get talked about much in the histories because it's not glamorous, but they do a lot. And later on, they're going to be absolutely crucial. In December, food is starting to run short, so the Crusaders are having to forage far from their camp, which is how they accidentally blunder into Dukak's relief army. Bohemond is in charge of that, together with good old and Robert of Flanders. He's around. Eventually, Tatikius goes home to plead with the emperor to send supplies or reinforcements. That never happens. In February 1098, Ridwan comes along with his relief force. And this is crucial. Again, like, this idea that the Crusaders are these armored brutes getting outmaneuvered by nimble Turkic, whatever. Bohemond lures Ridwan's relief army into a trap and smashes it. And Ridwan goes home as well, all the way back to Aleppo. Intermittent relief, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Fleets, you know, shipments arrive, but situation is still very bad. They're losing people to hunger. This is when people are kind of giving up and going home. Mm. And in the spring, in sort of April to May 1098, Bohemond unbeknownst to the other leaders, we think, is carrying out negotiations with someone inside Antioch, a guy called Firouz. And when news comes that Carboja is leading a relief army to Antioch, Bohemond proposes to the other leaders of the crusade. He says, "Say, fellas, you know, I have this idea. I don't know. Tell me what you think of it. But what if whoever captures Antioch, we let that person have Antioch and rule it? I mean, whoever it might be Robert of Flanders. It might be, you know, it might be Godfrey. It might be Raymond. Just whoever it might be, let's make them Lord of Antioch." Well, that's a silly idea. And then they all go, "Well, you know, we don't have much of a choice. Like, it seems like the situation is critical. Kerboja's almost here." And Bohemond goes, "Great. Now, as it happens, I have a plan." And so Firouz lets some of Bohemond's men in. And from there, they manage to get the rest of the army into the city. And they capture all of the city except for the citadel, which is still under the defenders' control right throughout this whole thing. And so with Kerboja on his way, even though they're in the city is depleted after a long siege. There's no food. There's no horses. Things are looking rough.
This is not a good situation. And so people are giving up at this point, as you mentioned. Is this happening immediately, or are they trying to defend the city? What's going on?
So I can't believe that I didn't say at the end of the last segment, what we need is a miracle. Because that is, of course, precisely what's going to come along. This is one of those confusing elements. Different authors, different writers about the crusade who were there have different views about the incident of the Holy Lance. Because the situation looks pretty bleak. Kerboja and his army turn up and they hugely outnumber the crusaders. And they haven't just done a lengthy siege where they're all sick and hungry and their horses are dead. So it looks pretty bad, but don't worry. They've got God on their side. So Kerboja turns up like first week of June, pushes the last defenders in from the outposts. And about a week after that, this fellow called Peter Bartholomew turns up. He has a meeting with Raymond and Adhemar in which he claims that St. Andrew appeared to him in a dream and told him where the Holy Lance is, the spear that pierced Christ's side while he's on the cross. Now, Adhemar presumably is aware that there is already just such a lance in the possession of the Byzantine emperor.
Is that the one that Keanu Reeves ends up with?
It's the sort of the knockoff lance.
The lance that Keanu Reeves ends up with is based on yet a third relic Holy Lance. I believe that one's that's a German one, I think.
That's all to do with the Nazis and their crazy shit, isn't it?
That's right. I have a story about that, but we're going to put it to one side because the Battle of Antioch is about to happen.
Yeah, do it.
So Adhemar is not immediately convinced by this, but Raymond seems to like it. We don't know very much about Peter Bartholomew. He was a servant. He worked for a Provençal knight who was in Raymond's retinue, and he is assigned to be looked after by Raymond's chaplain, a fellow called Raymond, who is the author of this history that's about, you know, that discusses it. But even with, you know, presumably he spoke to him and knew more about him, but he doesn't tell us that much. So it appears that, so they send Peter the Hermit. Remember Peter the Hermit? He's still around. In fact, he tried to run off again, if I recall correctly. And so they send him to try and negotiate with Kerboja toward the end of June. And he is unsuccessful, but presumably they're thinking that if Kerboja decides to execute the messenger, it's only Peter the Hermit.
not a love there, is there?
No, well, you wouldn't. I think the perception is that Peter the Hermit is sort of popular among the troops, but I don't think the leaders like him very much. So they make a plan, and it's not terrific. But they don't have much to work with. They put Bohemond in overall command. And on June 28th, they fight the Battle of Antioch and they win. Now, later Muslim historians say that this is because of an uncoordinated Muslim response. Basically that Kerboja is overconfident. He's not prepared. And so what happens is that the different divisions of his army basically kind of attack whenever they're ready rather than launching a coordinated attack. But those people are writing decades later. Mm. What the contemporary eyewitnesses, the people who were there, say is that angels came down and fought on behalf of the Crusaders. There's your primary sources. That's what they have to say about it.
Can't prove it didn't happen.
God did it. Now, you might say that these people have been fasting for 72 hours, wearing 40 pounds of armor in Syria in June, and they could have seen all sorts of things.
Out, yeah.
Yeah, out of their minds with terror and adrenaline.
It's actually surprising that the angels didn't descend on unicorns.
Yeah, so it's a great miracle, et cetera, et cetera. And then they decide, the army is exhausted. We're going to rest up here, and we're going to head out to Jerusalem in a couple of months. And this does not quite work out.
So this is where they're ultimately headed, isn't it? It's Jerusalem. They do get there, some of them.
That is the theory of the thing, yeah. Like a pretty small percentage of them compared to the ones that set out. Because Antioch's been rough.
Yeah.
So they immediately start kind of falling out over who's going to run Antioch. And the two main rivals at this point are Bohemond and Raymond.
It's not really surprising, is it?
And no. Bohemond, I think, has sort of figured, like, if Alexius isn't willing to come this far to take Antioch back from the Turks, he's also not willing to come this far to take Antioch back from me. So,
reasonable.
I might as well just stay here and be the Prince of Antioch and live in a big house and, you know, or go home to Bari and get, you know, bullied by my half-brothers. Like, forget this. Now, that's not how it's going to work out. Bohemond is, in fact, going to go back to Bari, but not for a while. And so there's a big squabble that goes on for a while. Raymond starts to kind of expand his territory out a little to the south of Antioch. They lay siege to a town called Marat al-Numan. That's where the famous reports of Crusader cannibalism come from. Eventually, Raymond kind of has no choice but to decide that he's going to go to Jerusalem because the troops are restless. They want to go to Jerusalem.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and they don't care if Raymond, like, builds up his power in the fertile Rouge Valley. Like, that's not their goal. And he doesn't head out until December 1098. So, again, it has been over a full year since they arrived in Antioch.
They just kind of, like, leave Bohemond in charge of the city, and anyone who isn't Bohemond heads off.
Yes, but not together.
Because that would be far too organized and reasonable, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes and no. The splitting up is, you know, on a defensive level, it's dangerous. But on an economic level, it's actually not that unwise because their transportation links between regions aren't fantastic, right? So they need to spread out so that they don't overtax the food resources of one area, basically, right? You'd rather have, I mean, not that they have 30,000 people, but like, you'd rather have like 10,000 people go to one place, 10,000 people go to the other place.
This is what drives me mad about things like Game of Thrones, where you see like 8 million people in an army by the wall and you're like, where are they eating from? Yeah.
Yes, right. That you don't keep them all in one place until the moment you need them. And shifting from one to the other is quite complex. In fairness, I always like people who go, where's the logistics in, like, there's nothing wrong with giving them some backpacks, but it's like, where's the farming? Like, don't ask that question unless you want to watch a bunch of scenes of, like, dudes farming, which doesn't sound that exciting compared to fighting zombies.
Oh, yeah, so they eventually sort of begin to march in separate groups down towards Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I think Tancred gets Galilee.
Yeah, so they by this point, they're pursuing a primarily diplomatic strategy. There's one or two little sieges on the way. Indeed, one of them is sort of not very very conducive to Raymond's reputation. All the credit that Raymond built up in Antioch is starting to bleed away as they head south toward Jerusalem. In particular, Peter Bartholomew finally loses it. In April 1099, and one of Robert's chaplains, a guy called Arnulf, accuses him of being a fraud, and he agrees to undergo a trial by fire, which, although we think about them as being the kind of thing that happens in the Middle Ages, it's actually not all that common. And he is burned to death. Which...
Well, that's one categorical verdict then, isn't it?
Yeah, but, I mean, that suggests... Now, again, the historical accounts differ. Raymond Evagulet, the guy who was looking after him, says that he made it through the fire unscathed, but then the mob were so eager to touch him that they actually hurt him really badly and he died. And then the pro-Bohemond history says, yeah, he walked through the fire and he got burned to death. But it implies that he didn't think he was lying? Because otherwise, surely you'd try to get out of walking into a fire. It's a really interesting... Like, that incident fascinates me, and I, you know, we'll never know exactly what happened, but I think it's a, really like, was he a fraud or did he believe his own hype? I don't know.
You're mad, wouldn't it?
So yes, they go through this whole thing, and finally, they rock up in Jerusalem. And by this time, sort of Godfrey has become the center of the crusading army. A lot of lords who had attached themselves to Raymond have begun to move toward Godfrey. Now, the awkward thing about Jerusalem is the Seljuks aren't even there anymore.
Yeah.
The Fatimids took it back in August 1098, which incidentally is also the month, I skipped this bit, but Adhemar died then, so they are without a papal legate.
Yeah.
At this point. And Peter Bartholomew said a bunch of stuff about how Adhemar came to him as a ghost and apologized for having doubted the Holy Lance, which is a bit insensitive, I felt.
Yeah.
Well,
let's finish off then by saying, so Jerusalem then, there is a power vacuum, and this is kind of the end of the First Crusade, isn't it?
Yes.
And you've already kind of explained, because we're supposed to ask you, how does Godfrey become king? But he is stepping into that vacuum, isn't he?
Yeah, so the siege of Jerusalem doesn't last anything like as long as the Antioch. It takes about 6 weeks. I'm bad at dates, but that sounds about right. And... yes. And so they have to decide who's going to be in charge, and no one can quite agree. So some people are like, oh, it should be a free city run by, the, well, not a free city, but it should be church property. Cause you know, it's Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It should be, but it's clear that there needs to be a military authority of some kind. Raymond turns it down. Not sure what's going on there. And Godfrey decides to set up and become King of Jerusalem. Now, people will tell you that Godfrey refused the title king because he would not wear a crown of gold in the city where Christ had worn a crown of thorns. And instead, he calls himself the Advocate of the Holy Sepulchre. But there's actually not that much evidence that he used the title Advocate of the Holy Sepulchre. He probably just called himself Prince or Duke, which was already his title.
Yeah.
And yeah, he kind of becomes king because he's the one that everybody can agree on. Raymond has territorial ambitions further north. You know, in the space between Antioch and Jerusalem. Bohemond is in Antioch and happy with that fact. You know, Godfrey is the other major leader of the crusade. He's got, and he sort of, they put a little
left.
Yeah. They put a little full stop on the thing by going out and thumping the Fatimids at the Battle of Ascalon.
Yeah.
Just to stop them from taking the city back. But they don't take the city of Ascalon, which is going to prove to be a huge problem for Jerusalem because it's going to mean that there's a Fatimid military base right in their front yard. And supposedly they don't take it because Godfrey and Raymond are too busy arguing about, who's going to rule it once they have it. That in fact, in the end, they don't have it.
And they've basically just set up 200 years of Franks arguing about who owns what and what's going to happen.
Yeah, for sure. And so this basically does develop into the Crusader states that we recognize. So Jerusalem in the south, then Tripoli, which is Raymond's, then Antioch, which is Bohemond, although he rules it himself for a very short period of time. Most of the time he's in jail or overseas, and Tancred is actually running it. And then Edessa under... initially Godfrey's brother Baldwin and then his other relative Baldwin up in the northeast, and that's not going to last because that's right up on the frontier, and it gets taken out in the mid 12th century, but the others are going to survive for quite a while, and so that's the landscape against which the subsequent crusades occur. It's very much determined by this formation of the Crusader states, which was kind of opportunistic. You know, no one sat down with
like a combination of second son syndrome, a situation that you say, like, I know Urban is the one where we look at him and go, yo, but you're saying that the situation was going to evolve eventually in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, maybe not in this precise form, but there was a combination of kind of, you know, overproduction in one area, a power vacuum in another, a desire to centralize papal authority, a rising excitement about, you know, going on high status pilgrimages, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, no one sat down with a map and went, okay, we're going to conquer all this territory and we're going to divide it into four parts. I think even as early as the Siege of Antioch, I don't think everybody is thinking we're going to stay here. It just kind of worked out that way.
Thank you so much, James, for coming on to giving us an overview, such a comprehensive overview of the First Crusade. It's brilliant. As I say, it's my favorite crusade, if you get to pick a favorite. Because it is, there's none of the context of the later ones where they're all trying, it's all following on from each other. This is the one where they first decided it'd be a great idea to get 100,000 in inverted commas people together and just go wandering across Asia.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry we've run a little long.
No, I love it. I think it's brilliant.
I should be praised for my restraint in not going down some of these side.
This is the thing.
There's so many of them.
Come back and do a crusading rabbit hole thing. We got to mention that are really fun, but would take us away from the narrative.
Sorry, we can do a listicle style. 10 things you didn't know. Yeah,
we'll come back and we'll do outtakes of the First Crusade.
That's right. What got left on the cutting room floor? Deleted scenes. All right, fantastic. Well, once again, thank you so much for having me. Kit, thank you so much for setting all this up. It's been amazing fun, and I'm really glad that I got the chance to do it.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.